Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello from the Henry Wellcome Auditorium here at Wellcome Collection in London. We're here to question a man at the heart of the most audacious and inspiring science project ever undertaken in the world. Imagine a 27-kilometre tunnel cut through the rock 100 metres beneath the landscape between the Alps and the Jura Mountains near Geneva. Imagine that the tunnel is cryogenically cooled to a temperature colder than outer space, and that protons are fired up with massive amounts of energy and shot round this tunnel, two beams in opposite directions, faster and faster until they come very close to the speed of light. Imagine, too, that when they achieve that 27-kilometre round trip in less than a second, they're crashed together with incredible force in multi-detecting magnetic chambers, thus recreating the conditions of the universe moments after the Big Bang. And then the resulting debris is photographed at a rate of 40 million snaps per second. Well, you can stop imagining, because after some teething problems, the Large Hadron Collider at CERN is now repaired and back in action, and shortly those high-impact collisions will be happening in the CMS detector, that's the compact muon solenoid detector, probably the most sophisticated machine on the planet. Its chief architect is the physicist Professor Tejinder Verdi from Imperial College. And it's his inspiration and dedication over 20 years that has led to the creation of the most innovative of CERN's detectors and the machine with the best chance of finding the mysterious Higgs boson. Can I have a round of applause, please, for Tejinder Jim Verdi? Thank you, Jim. Well, that was a very brief a summary of what might happen at CERN, but can you explain the importance of the work there? What's the purpose of the Large Hadron Collider?
Perhaps let me start by saying that the experiment and the accelerator we'll be discussing is in the field of particle physics. This is a modern name for a centuries-old effort started by Sir Isaac Newton in trying to understand the fundamental laws of nature that govern all physical phenomena. The experiment itself is likened to a cylindrical onion, which has four layers, principal layers, and each layer has a specific task. And altogether, they allow us to measure the energies, the directions, and identity of all the particles that are produced when two protons collide. So it's like two mosquitoes colliding with each other. But the energy that is contained in these mosquitoes is confined to a very, very tiny space. And it's the energy density that is created which mimics what happened in the early universe, 100th or 1,000th of a nanosecond after the Big Bang.
It's a thousandth of a nanosecond after
thousandth of a nanosecond after the Big Bang. Now, what we're trying to find out is what was the content of the universe at that time and what were the laws of nature operating at that time. And the content could contain particles like the Higgs boson. We might have to go through something of the order of 10,000 billion pairs of protons interacting to find such things. So it'll take some time to find the Higgs boson, which is responsible for, we believe, for giving mass to objects. We contain particles which have masses. If we did not have particles with masses, we wouldn't be here discussing, because we'll be puffs of radiation.
You're in charge of one of four experiments at Large Hadron Collider. This is the CMS, the Compact Muon Solenoid Experiment. Now the detector in question, of course, has taken a very long time to develop, and a lot of people have been involved in developing it. So just before we talk about the science, let's talk about this actually very remarkable international effort to build these detectors.
So the experiment was started by a handful of people, and there are about 3,000 scientists and engineers working on it at the moment. So the talents and the efforts and the resources of all of these scientists and engineers were needed to get to this stage. Now, in that, the first things we had to do was to go around the world, a sort of a grand tour, if you like, to countries like China, Taiwan, India, Pakistan, Iran, Turkey, Croatia, Serbia, Cyprus, Greece. So some of these countries, they not necessarily have had terribly good relations, but in the project, and I can reel off and continue, there are 40 countries in the CMS experiment. There are Russia, the former Soviet Union states, all of the European countries, essentially, US, and some South American states. So we had to put all of this together, and we had to go and understand what was the capability of the scientists in the countries that I've just listed, and try to build the experiment using our knowledge of their capabilities, such that the experiment would be able to work. So let's take the case of China, for example. One instrument was a cart, we call it, which was built in a shipyard in China. And another was a set of detectors, which were designed by the Americans, but built in China and tested in China, and the Chinese scientists are responsible for them. Another one could be, for example, Russia. They needed brass for an instrument, and this brass had special characteristics, and in fact it was cartridge brass. So some bright technician in Russia working on CMS thought, well, maybe what we could do is to take some of the decommissioned shells of the Russian Northern Fleet, melt the shell casings, create plates, and then the plates were then sent to Minsk in Belarusia to be machined, and sent then to Geneva, and the Russians came over from Russia and Belarusia and to assemble it in the experiment. So these kind of things which are happening. But also high-tech items in the UK, for example, Imperial College and Rutherford Lab, plus CERN, developed radiation-hard electronics, very high-speed electronics, which didn't really exist at the time.
So these things have been, had to be imagined, worked out, then developed so that the experiment could be set up there. I'm fascinated by the idea that you had shell casings from the Northern Russian fleet now built into this machine. And in fact, in the development of some of these things, really very remarkable new items have come out of it.
Absolutely. We found that, for example, to take the Higgs boson, which we'll come to later, the best material we could think of was a crystal, a lead tungstate crystal. It's made out of lead, tungsten, a little bit of oxygen, and it's very transparent, more transparent than glass, and it's very radiation hard. When we started about 20 years ago, these objects existed in a handful of quantities. When particles go through these detectors, they generate showers which lead to light being emitted. The amount of light that is emitted is proportional to the energy that goes into these crystals, and the light has to be detected by photodetectors. And since we're going to be in a very high magnetic field, we couldn't use the conventional sensors at that time, photosensors. So we had to look for something new. And at that time, there were some research samples which existed. And we combined these two things and made them work. And these crystals, we had about 10 or 12 at the time. There are about 75,000 of them inside the experiment. And it took a Russian factory, a converted Russian military industrial factory, 10 years to grow these crystals. And the last one came March of last year. And it was installed in the experiment in September and taking data.
Now, there are 75,000 of these crystals out there. And it needed diplomatic talents, didn't it? Because in the 10 years that it took that Russian factory to produce what you wanted, you had to keep on telling them that the crystals weren't quite ready yet.
Right.
Well, it's a very remarkable story how this extraordinary experiment has been built. So many countries have taken part. So much new technology has been invented in order to set it up. It is a remarkable story. And just before we go to the science that's going to be done as a result of this remarkable story, are there any questions anybody would like to ask about that, about the building up of all the installations and detectors at CERN? A question over here.
My name is Sam Ray. You mentioned billions of collisions a second, a lot of collisions anyway. How can you possibly record what's happening and how can you process it? Did you have to develop a supercomputer to do that?
Right, I think that's a good question. The CMS detector can be likened to a 3D digital camera. It has 100 million pixels because it's got 100 million channels, electronics channels. So it's a 100 megapixel 3D digital camera. The protons are organized in bunches. And each bunch contains 100 billion protons. And they're crossing each other 40 million times a second in the heart of the CMS detector. So this digital camera has to be able to look at each one of those crossings. So it is a digital camera that is taking 40 million pictures every second. And the size of the picture is the size of the digital picture that you take, a few megabytes. So you're absolutely right. It is an enormous computing challenge. So what one does is to take the detector, an object which is 12,500 tons, 30 meters in length, 15 meters in diameter, The experiment is 100 meters underground, and the information is transmitted by 500 to 600 optical fibers, which send about 100,000 megabytes, or in fact a few 100,000 megabytes every second into the computers. So there are 10,000 cores. One picture is sent to the next free core in this farm of computers, and then you run what we call physics code or an analysis code, and there you start looking at other features inside the event, characteristics, if you like, and keep only the 300 or 500 most interesting ones. And these then are peeled off and sent to the main site of CERN, where there's another large bank of computers which is analyzing these 300 frames. You reconstruct them, and these are then sent to seven centers dotted around the globe: Taiwan, Germany, Italy, France, UK, US, Spain. And these are then tied to about 50 other centers, computer centers, which then get the data, which are taken, let's say, a couple of hours ago, and they're sitting on the desktop of a physicist who's going to analyze the data. And for this, CERN has had to develop, alongside the experiments, what's called the computing grid. So this is a sort of a successor to the World Wide Web, because we need it to do our analysis. So this is an enormous amount of data which is being spread around in real time, and all of it must work. All of the wheels and the cogs must work.
Well, that's absolutely marvelous, because that's a lovely moment where, in order to explain what the Higgs boson is, and that's one of the main things that you're looking for in the experiment, perhaps just a little refresher. I know everybody here was just last night reading some physics in the bath, but perhaps you might just remind them of the standard model, the standard picture that we have at the moment of the atom.
Right. If we take, for example, a salt crystal, it's a crystal, and its atoms are arranged in a very uniform way in a lattice. It's regularly placed. Now, if you go look inside, and you'll find atoms. Now, if you go look inside atoms, you'll find electrons whizzing around a nucleus. Now, if you go look further, you look at the nucleus, which contains neutrons and protons. And then if you have even more powerful microscopes or accelerators, you'll find inside neutrons and protons quarks. And they're bound together in the neutron or a proton by what we call gluons, for want of imagination. So they glue the quarks into a proton. So that's all that is needed to describe everything we see. We touch what we are. So that is the standard model, if you like. These are matter particles. It contains particles which mediate the forces. We are very familiar with the electromagnetic force when two magnets attract or repel. But that force is transmitted, if you like, by photons. So these are the mediators of the force. For the weak interaction, it's the Ws and Zs. And for the strong interaction, which holds the quarks and gluons together, is the gluon.
So let me just get that clear. We've got pairs of quarks, and we've got a set of particles which convey forces between them, combine them.
Okay. That's right. Now, the standard model is perhaps the crowning achievement of 20th century science. It contains the quantum theories, and they're relativistic quantum theories of the strong interaction, the one I just described, the weak interaction, which is powering the sun, and the electromagnetic interaction. The only one that is missing is gravity, and we actually don't have a quantum theory of gravity and don't know when we're going to get it. One of the conjectures is that it's the Higgs mechanism which regulates it. It provides mass, but it also can provide the solution. So we know there's something going to happen at the LHC energies, and we've got to find out what it is.
Okay, now just before we get on to that bit, we need also to be clear about why it is that it matters that we should find the Higgs particle, because there's a mystery, isn't there, about how any particle gets mass.
Absolutely. So one of the thoughts is that the favoured mechanism is the Higgs mechanism. Now, how do particles get mass? How does anything get mass? And the notion is that the universe, there's a field which pervades the universe, and particles which start off as being massless interact with this field. And the stronger the interaction is, the higher the mass they acquire. And the photon, which is a light particle, has zero mass, strictly zero mass. It does not interact with this field, so it doesn't get a mass. Now, this is a quantum field. So for all quantum fields, there's a quantum associated with it, For example, for the electromagnetic field, it's a photon. For the Higgs field, it's the Higgs boson.
Excellent. So the Higgs boson is the main target. It's not the only thing that you're looking for in the Large Hadron Collider experiments, but it's the main thing that you're looking for. How will you know when you've spotted it?
This is quite a rare occurrence, so it'll take some time. We might have to go through 10,000 billion pairs of protons interacting, so it'll take several years to accumulate enough proton-proton collisions to see maybe something like an order of 1,000 events sitting over a certain background. So the Higgs boson, since it's very heavy, is essentially created at rest because there's not enough energy to make it move. It's just enough to make it exist. So in a mass range which is favored, the Higgs boson decays into two photons. And the idea is to measure the energy of the photons as precisely as possible. And if you see a large number of pairs of protons, but in one place of this quantity, there are many more than expected, then you've found the Higgs boson. This is, as I keep saying, it's a conjecture, it's a favored conjecture. But nature could have done something different.
But it's still going to be very informative if you don't, after all those experiments, after all those many, many millions and billions of collisions, seen anything that resembles the Higgs, you're still going to learn something from that, aren't you? It's going to tell us something really important about the standard model.
If it's not the Higgs, it'll be something different, which has solved this problem. The problem must be solved at the LHC energy. So if the Higgs doesn't exist, it'll be something else.
Now, if there are Higgs, they exist very fleetingly, don't they?
That's right.
All the Higgs that currently exist and which are probably made by, what would you say, by cosmic ray collisions outside the Earth's atmosphere?
Yes.
Anything which is local in the way of Higgs wouldn't be detected by the machine, would it?
No. In fact, it is possible. We are continually bombarded by very high-energy cosmic rays. In fact, energies which are even higher than the ones that we can have with the LHC. We could detect them. They may well be being produced, but they're not produced in controlled conditions. Now, these Higgs bosons existed in the early universe, and they decayed out, and so they don't exist in normal fashion. So we'll be producing them in controlled conditions for the first time, hopefully, and then studying them.
Now, among the other things that you might be producing in these collisions are mini black holes.
Yes.
There are some scare stories about those mini black holes. They might cease to be mini, become maxi, and gobble us all up.
Yes, in a sense, these cosmic rays have very high energies. So if these black holes exist, they are being produced. So in a sense, only on Earth, nature has done the experiment like the LHC millions of times already, and we are still here. And if you bring in the other astronomical bodies, like the Sun, for example, they're billions and billions of times. So there is absolutely no danger.
Well, that's a very optimistic view. Now, surely there are lots of questions out there about the science of the Large Hadron Collider experiment. There was a question up at the back.
Max Rossiter, North London. How does this research push forward unifying quantum theory with general relativity?
I mean, that is one of the big questions. If we did not do this experiment, we can't even dream of trying to answer that question with any certainty because we couldn't have tested it. Now, the extra dimension theories are interesting. We might live in 10. I can't imagine 10. I have difficulty imagining 4, by the way, which is the ones that we live in. But we have 3 space dimensions. And what happens if you can go from 3 to 2 and say if you were to live in a 2-dimensional world, what would happen? What would happen is the laws of nature like electromagnetism, gravitation, Newton's law, for example, would change. It looks different in 2 dimensions than in 3. And so when you go to 10 dimensions, the laws change. And that is one avenue. The reason for extra dimensions is to bring gravity into the fold. Is that the way nature has chosen to do it? We don't know. We'll find out.
Now, this whole project, taking nearly 20 years, as you say, is taking something in the region of $3 to $4 billion. When we visited CERN, we were chatting to you, I was talking to one of your colleagues who said that the experiment has almost paid for itself already in the way of spin-offs. Some of the applications, for example, to biomedical science also.
If one wants to be at the frontier of technology, you have to be at the frontier of knowledge, because knowledge actually feeds into technologies. We have a tradition in particle physics of having large collaborations, and the large groups of scientists they need to share rapidly the data that is being generated. In that sense, there was a reason for why, for example, the World Wide Web was invented at CERN, because there was a need for scientists to share the data. Both the machine and the experiments contain instruments which really push the limits of industry. These crystals and devices which detect the light, which work in a very high magnetic field, now we use them in medical imaging in positron emission tomography cameras. What is being done at the moment is to couple these cameras with magnetic resonance imaging devices. Now, coupling these devices was a bit difficult because of the magnetic field. So the sensors that we used, they're called silicon avalanche photodiodes, are actually now being coupled to these devices, and trials are being done. And the sort of things, again, just to give you an example, helium itself was only liquefied about 100 years ago. And there was a Dutch physicist who liquefied half a cupful. The LHC, we liquefy 32,000 litres of helium every hour.
32,000 litres an hour. Yeah.
32,000 litres an hour. So it is the biggest refrigerator in the world as well. So if you get a flavour of the technological challenges which had to be overcome, the numbers are mind-boggling even for us.
Well, now, these first collisions happening just before Christmas, what are you hoping to see at this very early stage? I know you said earlier it's going to take a very long time for big results to start coming out, a long time for people to analyse and think about those results. But you'll be expecting some things to start happening now that things are up and running again.
The first thing we've got to do when we get the collisions is to check that with the collisions the experiment is also working well. And that we will hope to do soon. And then the energy of the machine will be ramped up cautiously, and we'll take it up to about 1 TeV. Next year, it'll be ramped up to higher energies. Now, the first thing that we will be doing next year is to then check that the experiment is observing phenomena which are predicted by this theory that I mentioned, which is the standard model, correctly. And once we've measured all of these things, we will be looking for new things. Now, of course, we'll be looking for the new things in parallel as well, but we won't be able to claim anything until we've understood the detector physics-wise as well. Now, one other thing that I should perhaps mention so that one gets a feel for how the work will be done. I mentioned 1 billion pairs of protons interacting every second, and that is at design performance. So when we start this year, we'll be starting, the first collision will be starting at the level of between 100 and 1,000 a second, and we have to get up to 1 billion. But we hope by the end of next year we'll be talking about 1/10 million and then making the final steps later on.
Now, an opportunity to ask Jim any questions about anything that we've talked about during the course of the evening. There's a question up there.
David Glue, Elephant and Castle. Let's see, you haven't mentioned the Algerian physicist at LHC, arrested in France 2 months ago and charged with conspiracy to commit terrorism. In other words, there's plenty of religious extremists in the world who regard humanity as degraded and want to bring about the end of the world. So, in other words, the LHC is likely, as you say, to create new laws of physics or extra dimensions, and obviously I'm terrified you'll succeed and you will destroy the world.
As I was mentioning earlier, nature produces collisions in the upper atmosphere which are even higher energy than the ones we will produce at the LHC. So nature has been doing this experiment for billions of years. So the particles that we conjecture would be produced in the upper atmosphere. We're not there to observe them. Doesn't mean to say they're not produced, but we're still here. We exist.
This lady down in the second row.
What happens if your experiment doesn't work, and at what point will you know you haven't succeeded?
What experiments do is to either confirm a theory or refute it. But it always provides new information as to what is the path. I started by saying particle physics is a centuries-old effort to understand the laws of nature. Now, the hope and the expectation is that what we'll find at the LHC will revolutionise our conception of how nature works at the fundamental level, perhaps in a manner not too dissimilar from what Einstein did 100 years ago when he altered our notions of space and time. So these are fundamental experiments, and if we don't do these experiments, we actually don't know which way to go ahead. It's a path started by Newton. We have not finished it, by far not finished it, and this will be the end.
Well, I said at the outset of all this that this is the greatest scientific experiment which has ever been built, certainly on this planet. It is a most remarkable thing. And it was one of the great days of my life to go to CERN, really exhilarating experience to see it. And I was struck by something, which is that I do a bit of NGO work at the Human Rights Council of the UN in Geneva. And here at CERN, a couple of miles away from the UN, was this great collaborative effort. Many countries, you would think of them as at odds with one another, but there they were collaborating at CERN in this magnificent way. The day we were there, Egypt was applying to sign up to become part of the project as well. A couple of miles away at the UN, the same folks were at one another's throats. And I think this is a testament to science. And just to repeat, because I think it's a very, very important point, whatever happens at CERN is going to be a major breakthrough in our understanding of this world of ours. And because Jim has been at the very centre of this and one of the architects of it, it's been a magnificent achievement and deserves at very least a round of applause.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. The details of them all go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.